Today is Wednesday, May 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, world leaders react to President Trump's threat to withdraw the U.S. from the World Health Organization.
In times like these, the greatest act of courage is to play as a team.
The suspected funder of Rwanda's genocide makes his first court appearance after being arrested over the weekend following a 26-year manhunt. Also ahead, Beyonce is the latest name of celebrities who will deliver online commencement speeches to graduating students. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump is threatening to permanently end funding for the World Health Organization if it doesn't commit to improvements within 30 days. Trump tweeted a letter that he sent to the World Health Organization saying he's also considering revoking U.S. membership with the organization. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
The letter went on to say the only way forward for the WHO is if it can actually demonstrate independence from China. Trump has repeatedly said the agency has been siding with China. The WHO has agreed to launch an independent evaluation of its handling of the coronavirus following complaints from member states.
Trump's threats prompted pushback from leaders in Europe, including EU Commission von der Leyen, during a teleconference address to the World Health Assembly. She said scrutinizing the WHO's role should come later, not in the middle of a pandemic.
We should not look into ways to modernize the WHO, to see what should be done for the WHO to continue to live up to the new challenges, because we need multilateral approaches. But let us for now focus on our most immediate challenge.
The World Health Organization's director general said Tuesday that he will continue leading the global fight against the coronavirus pandemic. Meanwhile, Trump revealed he is taking an anti-malaria drug despite warnings from his own administration's health experts. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The FDA has said hydroxychloroquine should only be administered for COVID-19 in hospital or research settings due to potentially fatal side effects.
All I can tell you is, so far, I seem to be okay.
But some public health experts worry the president's setting up people to misuse hydroxychloroquine. His spokeswoman says tens of millions already use it for other purposes. The FDA's chief says the decision to take any drug is ultimately between a patient and doctor. The president has said his doctor did not recommend it, but he asked the White House physician to get it. Sagar Magani, Washington.
The novel coronavirus continues to grip many parts of the world, which are already dealing with violence and conflict. International organization Doctors Without Borders has been providing health care in many challenging regions across 70 countries. And recently, one of their midwives died in an attack on a hospital maternity ward in Kabul, Afghanistan, where mothers and newborns were also killed. Today's second half of my interview with Doctors Without Borders USA Executive Director Avril Benoit, we talk about some of the places of rising concern.
It is so difficult to manage operations in a place like South Sudan or northeastern Nigeria in normal times, or Democratic Republic of Congo, all these kinds of countries where we tend to focus in the places where there's a lot of instability, conflict, where you might have a very difficult and serious measles outbreak at the same time. We're actually seeing really troubling patterns in certain countries where we have quite large operations: Nigeria, Central African Republic, Sudan, Sierra Leone, Chad, Senegal. These are places where we have medical teams that are working. And yeah, they have to juggle quite a lot right now because they're delivering babies. They are trying to offer nutritional support to malnourished children. They're dealing with war wounds, people on the run, fleeing violence or conflict in Syria, in Iraq, and so forth. People whose immunity is suppressed, perhaps from living in a refugee camp or in a camp for internally displaced people. So all the general healthcare activities, we're trying to preserve those while at the same time keep an eye on COVID-19, protect our staff also. We need the personal protective equipment to be able to ensure that our staff are healthy and able to work safely in order to save the people that they're trying to treat for all the other things as well. And this makes it incredibly stressful.
You all are sort of tracking hotspots and moving as needed, given that this is a moving, evolving situation?
The international and subnational travel restrictions actually make it very difficult for us to move the specialist teams from A to B, but we are managing. It's also sometimes difficult to get the cargo shipments in for the personal protective equipment and other medical supplies that would be necessary. Despite those obstacles, we are managing to maintain a fairly flexible approach to these emergency operations.
Are there any particular places around the world, whether it be a country in Africa or the Middle East, that you are seeing a pattern of growing concern that this virus is just beginning to be known how severe it might be?
We look at the models. We look at the reports, which are consolidated by the World Health Organization.
Mm-hmm.
And what we are seeing in Afghanistan is quite a concern to us. As you know, we had recently a horrific attack on the maternity ward in a hospital we've been supporting in Kabul for many years. They came in and specifically sought to kill the mothers and newborn children. The violence is absolutely shocking. In that environment, we also know, because of our work in parts of Afghanistan, that there's very little testing capacity. In those areas close to Iran, which has had a very high burden of COVID-19, we've also been striving to mobilize extra support. So you can imagine the difficulty of thinking, well, are we being targeted here? Are the mothers we're looking after here being targeted, assassinated in cold blood, just as they're delivering babies, at a time when we're also trying to stop a pandemic from wreaking havoc in the country? The complexity of being able to work in an environment like that has us extremely concerned. And we call on everyone who is holding a gun in those kind of regions to please spare the population that is going through enough with this pandemic, to try to certainly spare the health structures. They should be not targets for the kind of violence in wartime that we've seen far too often. And we need to be able to do our work to save people and to stop this pandemic. And so that, I would say, is a huge concern of ours. It's a concern of anyone who is a doctor, a nurse, a caregiver in a place where this additional burden of conflict, the violence that sends people running and fleeing and crowding and hiding, this is no way to be able to stop a pandemic in regions like that.
Were any of your people wounded or killed in that attack?
Yeah, yes. From what we hear already, one of our midwives was killed. It's one of the deadliest attacks we've ever experienced. At this point, the official numbers are indicating that 24 people were killed. A large majority of them were patients, were women.
Why would they target mothers giving birth?
Can you imagine? It's absolutely shocking. That's the madness of war. I mean, there's just no explaining this.
Doctors Without Borders, USA Executive Director Avril Benoit. Kenyan authorities have forcibly evicted more than 7,000 people from land in Nairobi slums over the last month, defying a court order. Authorities say they demolished homes because they were built on public land. Critics say mass evictions during a pandemic are inhumane and could further spread the coronavirus. Mohamed Youssef reports from Nairobi.
42-year-old Daniel Ndungu saw the three tractors coming before his home was demolished last week. We saw police officers coming into the area. They blocked the road and left the only one used by tractors, Ndungu says. At around 9, they started demolition. They didn't care whether there were children in the house or anything else. They began demolition, he says. Defying a court order, authorities on Friday forcibly evicted Ndungu's family and other Nairobi slum dwellers, making them homeless in the middle of the coronavirus pandemic. Ndungu says he will stay here in the cold and wait. Now, there is nowhere to go, he says. Even if I want to move to a new place, there is no place to move to, and I have no money. Moving to a new place, people won't accept you because they will say you have coronavirus. Others who could moved into the crowded dwellings of friends and relatives. The evictions which started in April, left over 5,000 people homeless earlier this month in Nairobi's Kariobangi neighborhood. The state-run Nairobi City Water and Sewerage Company claims ownership of the land and says the families have been occupying it illegally since 2008.
People are told this in advance. You are actually sitting on public land. There's a project that is terminating here. We may be able to, you know, probably open up and then pump sewage in this direction. People know this, but then either people don't move or they just continue staying there.
37-year-old Bucha Hussein Wako says he has government receipts showing he owns the land he was forced from. But public land is too often sold illegally in Kenya, leaving those who were cheated out of their money, like Wako, also homeless. They demolished our home and poor people's homes. I slept in the cold for 2 days, and there is a coronavirus pandemic, Wako says. They told us to go back home when we demonstrated against the demolition. They disrupted it and tear gassed us, he says. A small riot erupted earlier this month as the evicted clashed with police in Kariobangi and set fire to cars and tires. A Kenyan high court had earlier ordered a halt to further demolitions until a petition by residents is heard in June. But for thousands of Kenyans already left homeless, those still being evicted, there's little hope for justice. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. Some museums in Rome reopened Tuesday after being closed for nearly 3 months due to the coronavirus lockdown. Visitors were subject to temperature checks, hand sanitizer, and social distancing measures before entering. The Colosseum and the Vatican Museum remain closed. New York City's health department says that some neighborhoods have seen death rates from the novel coronavirus nearly 15 times higher than others, showing the disproportionate toll taken on poor communities. The data shows a breakdown on the number of the deaths in each of the city's more than 60 zip codes. The highest death rate was seen on the edge of Brooklyn in a neighborhood dominated by a large subsidized housing development. And Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas announced Tuesday that he will scrap all deals with Israel and the United States, including security agreements, in protest against Israel's plans to annex the West Bank. The Palestinians claim the entire West Bank, captured by Israel in the 1967 Mideast War, as what could be the heartland of their independent state. Stay with VOA for all the latest U.S. and world news.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
And AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
VOA's International Edition continues. The man believed to be the mastermind behind the 1994 Rwandan genocide made his first court appearance before a Paris courtroom on Tuesday, 3 days after French police arrested him in a Paris suburb after a 26-year manhunt. Now 84 years old, Felicien Kabuga is accused of funding militias that massacred around 800,000 people. He was indicted in 1997 on 7 criminal counts, including genocide. Joining us now for an update is Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Catherine, what can you tell us about this brief first court appearance?
Felicien Kabuga was taken to the Paris courtyard from prison under heavy guard. He arrived at the courtroom really just for a procedural appearance. The judge advised him that there was this international arrest warrant out for him, and that this international arrest warrant was part of a process, of which a process that the French judicial system approves of, and that that warrant has been examined, has found to be good. Where we go from here now is that he is now meant to reappear before a judge later today, Wednesday, and that judge will go over the information again. We'll go and see what charges are on that docket to see whether or not he can then be handed over to the tribunal. Kabuga's defense lawyers, however, have said that on the one hand, that they will challenge that bid for extradition, and also they are very angry with the Paris police for having described their client as being responsible for the genocide. They say that no, he hasn't been charged, hasn't found guilty. And we've also been advised by his lawyers that he will challenge that bid to extradite him, particularly to Tanzania.
Do we have any idea what kind of condition he was in and any reaction that he may have outwardly shown?
No, we have none at all. The only evidence which we have of his health comes from the prosecutors in the Hague. They say that he is of an advanced age, that he didn't put up any resistance when police broke into his apartment in Paris on Saturday morning and arrested him.
And I understand there are some more details coming out about what led to his capture after all this time.
Yes, what we are learning is that there was actually a changed investigative strategy put in place by investigators from the tribunal. They started that around 2.5 years ago. They essentially went right back to the start, to the period of 2007, when Kabuga had surgery in Germany. And from that point on, they went and they traced every one of his associates, every one of his children. They went over their bank details, all their financial investigations, all their telephone numbers, all the addresses. And within the last year, they narrowed it down to Kabuga possibly living in the United Kingdom, France, or Belgium. And it was only about 2 months ago that investigators discovered, with the help of French authorities, that one of Kabuga's children actually rented a small apartment in Paris. And it was from there that French authorities were able to locate the suspect again. Again, a bit of a fluke. It was really only because of the lockdown here in France with the COVID-19 alert that authorities had so much time on their hands. They said they just literally gave over the last 2 months for this operation.
How long could it be before he actually goes to trial, given he's already 84 years old?
An interesting question. On the one hand, you've got this court hearing on Wednesday. The judges there have up to 2 weeks before they have to give their written judgment on that. So that's at least another 2 weeks. Then if Kabuga decides to appeal that, that could take another couple of weeks. So we're talking about possibly months before he gets transferred. We're then talking about where he gets transferred to. In the first instance, he would be transferred to The Hague in the Netherlands, but they have said there at the tribunal they would like to see him on trial in Tanzania, in Arusha, which is where the tribunal is. However, we again come into problems there because how could he be transferred there? Travel restrictions at the moment because of COVID-19. So even though we would have that first phase in The Hague, when you look at what the defense has to get together, when you look at what getting him there to The Hague, you're talking about at least a year, all going well, before he could possibly stand trial. That is, again, if his health stands up.
That could be adding more frustration to many survivors and victims who have been waiting a very long time and were wondering if he would ever be held responsible or accountable for this horrific event.
These survivors have so many questions now. They have questions about who helped Kabuga in the last 26 years? Who helped him cross borders? Who gave him passports? Apparently, he had at least 10 different passports from different countries and different names. Who told him over the years that justice was closing in on him? And will these accomplices be charged at some stage? And clearly, he didn't act on his own. He had a whole group, a whole network of associates who helped him for these last 26 years to stay on the run.
Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. You're listening to International Edition. Levels of carbon pollution fell around the world during this pandemic shutdown, AP science writer Seth Borenstein reports.
An international team of scientists found that at the peak of lockdown in April, carbon dioxide pollution levels globally dropped about 17%. But they're heading back up in the end of April and into May. For the year, the scientists figure it will be about 4 to 7% less than last year. That's the biggest drop since World War II. But the same scientists say this is like a drop in the bucket with carbon dioxide pollution, which stays in the atmosphere for decades, if not a century. I'm Seth Borenstein.
Botswana is investigating the mysterious death of 56 elephants in the last 2 months. Authorities have ruled out poaching as all carcasses were found intact. Mukdisi Dube reports from the capital of Gaborone.
The country's Minister of Environment, Natural Resources, Conservation and Tourism says 12 elephants were found dead last week in villages in the Okavango Delta Panhandle. In March, 44 animals died, but wildlife officials have ruled out poaching in the separate incidents. Wildlife officer Dimakatso Ntsebe downplayed the possibility of farmers poisoning the elephants who tend to eat and stomp on crops. A local farmer says it is difficult to know the cause of death, but says elephants are a constant menace.
Farmers had a good harvest this year, but they constantly face problems with the encroaching animals. Although it is a rare occurrence, it might be something else, but you'll have to wait and see the investigations.
Local conservationist Ive Mebs says the animals could have died of natural causes.
Because it is also possible that it is a natural phenomenon from the disease anthrax, which occurs in the Botswana occasionally, especially after good rain season or after severe drought. Poisoning is not something common up that way, but I think we should once more wait for the pathology from the Department of Wildlife and National Parks to find out whether this is indeed poison or it might be, as I say, a natural anthrax phenomenon.
Fellow conservationist Neil Feet says if the cause of death was poisoning, other species could be dying as well.
I wonder why we haven't had reports of other species also dying off. If elephants are eating the poison, then it surely means that other things would also be eating it.
The public has been urged against consuming meat from the dead carcasses. Botswana has the largest elephant population in Africa, numbering over 130,000 animals. Mqondisi Dube for VOA News, Gaborone.
Like other top athletes, the long-distance runners of East Africa are feeling the impact of the coronavirus pandemic. Runners from Kenya, Ethiopia, and other countries are missing out on months of group training, competition, and income. Some have had to find other ways to make a living. Martha Vanderwolf reports from Amsterdam.
Ethiopian runner Mimi Belete competes internationally for Bahrain and was training to participate in her third Olympics this summer. With training camps being shut down because of the coronavirus, Mimi is now training by herself on the outskirts of Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa.
It's difficult because, you know, when you're training with group, it's much easier. And when you're training with group, you feel like powerful. You're training alone. Sometimes I feel like very weak, hopeless sometimes.
While Mimi is missing out on potential prize money and starting fees, she feels fortunate that Bahrain is paying her a salary. Michelle Booting, a Dutch manager of more than 30 Kenyan athletes, says less prominent runners and those just starting out don't have that kind of cushion.
Most African countries don't have like a stipendium for their athletes, so the alternatives to make money, they really have to look outside the athletics. In East Africa, many athletes, and especially in Kenya, have like a small farm or they have small businesses that they have opened up, and some focus more on that now. But running-wise, there's very little you can do to make money.
The pandemic forced the postponement of top spring races like the Boston Marathon. The Olympics were due to take place in Tokyo in July and August, but that too was postponed. There's a small chance some of the fall races might take place, although the Berlin Marathon, an important one for top athletes, has already been cancelled. The cancellation of the races has Ethiopian runner-turned-coach Getane Tesema worried. He is a coach with a Dutch-based agency training top athletes such as Berhanu Legesse, who won the Tokyo Marathon twice. Getane is not only worried about the condition of his runners now that they train by themselves, but also about their financial future.
You can say there are three kinds of groups in this case.
athletes who has who won a lot of prize money, they don't have a problem at all. And athletes who went aboard and won some races, and certainly there are athletes, there are upcoming athletes, they don't have income at all. And that group, they are really hurting right now with income.
The Tokyo Summer Olympics are now scheduled for 2021 if the pandemic is brought under control. Mimi Belete had initially qualified to run for Bahrain, but now she is unsure if she has to compete in new races to confirm her spot on the Olympic team. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Amsterdam.
After a delay due to France's coronavirus lockdown, a special raffle will now award the winner of an original oil painting by Pablo Picasso. VOA's David Byrd reports the lucky person will get Picasso's Nature Morte, estimated to be worth $2 to $3 million, with proceeds from the raffle going to help a charity in Africa.
The oil on canvas painting, called Nature Morte, or Still Life, was done in 1921. It includes a small wooden-looking tabletop with several pieces of paper and a glass of absinthe covering the pages of a journal. Picasso's signature is in the upper left corner. Nature Morte has been valued at between $2 and $3 million, but now one lucky winner will get it for just 100 euros. Television producer Perry Cochin is the organizer of the raffle.
Picasso is the most famous artist ever. Everywhere where you go in the world, you go to the Far East, to the West Coast, anywhere you go, everyone knows who is Picasso. Even if you don't know the work of Picasso into details, you know who is Picasso. You've heard about Picasso. I think he's the most famous.
Art historian and raffle co-organizer Adabel Riel Madavi says the Nature Morte painting was done at an important time in Picasso's life and work as he was transitioning from the Cubist style to neoclassicism.
1921 is really a pivot in his work. And this, as from this year, he's going to mix the styles. So in this painting, there is a piece of journal and a glass of absinthe that is shown in the first plan. And they all squashed, obviously, like they would be in Cubism. And yet it is not a collage like he would have done in 1912, but it is an oil painting. So it is a classic painting with the elements of Cubism.
The painting has been part of the collection of Monaco resident David Namad, the owner of 300 Picasso paintings and drawings. He says he was motivated to sell the painting because the raffle money will go to charity.
I think this painting is extremely chic. And the fact that it is small, it makes it even not pretentious, you know, a small jewel.
The event was supposed to take place on March 30th, but was delayed because of France's lockdown measures to prevent spread of the coronavirus. Raffle organizers had hoped to raise more than $20 million, but because of the pandemic, they have raised about $5.5 million from 50,000 tickets sold. Proceeds of the raffle will go to CARE to help provide clean water supplies for children in Africa. I'm David Byrd, VOA News. Now we had a
good time. And as graduation season continues, Beyoncé has been added to the list of guest speakers for YouTube's virtual commencement ceremony. YouTube announced Tuesday that Beyoncé will deliver an inspirational message to the 2020 class for its Dear Class of 2020 event, which takes place on June 6th. Barack and Michelle Obama will also speak at the virtual celebration, which will include appearances from Taylor Swift, Lady Gaga, Bill and Melinda Gates, Jennifer Lopez, former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, Demi Lovato, and many, many more. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Please take care and be well. Before I let you...